Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. This is Yaakov Katz, and this week I'm flying solo. Our show will be from the conference we held on Monday in New York City to mark the upcoming 90th anniversary of our newspaper, which came out for the first time on December 1st, 1932. It was then a small, thin paper printed in Jerusalem. Its name, the Palestine Post, and that first week, 1,200 copies were printed. The paper was founded by Gershon Agron, a Russian-born Zionist activist who joined the Jewish Legion, fought in the First World War, became a journalist in the United States, and then moved to Israel where he worked in Zionist organizations until 1932 when he founded the Post. A few years later, he would actually become mayor of Jerusalem. His vision, to create a newspaper that could tell the world what was happening within this ancient land, but also within the wider region. In those early years, the Post told the story of life in Israel under the British mandate. With the rise of Hitler, the paper diverted its attention to focus on the developing tragedy in Europe, as well as the struggle for a Jewish homeland. From tragedy, though, the paper turned to redemption, as the fight for Jewish independence in the land of Israel was won, and the sovereign state of Israel was born. In 1950, it would change its name and become known as we are today, the Jerusalem Post. In the 90 years that this newspaper has been around, it has flourished because we stick to our principles of providing balanced news coverage, thought-provoking analysis, and hard-hitting commentary. Running a newspaper and working in the media in 2022 is very different than the way it was in 1932. The digital race, social media, the need for speed, and the politicization of facts and news has made this all the more complicated. In a country as political as Israel, as you know, Lahav and I talk often about the upcoming fifth election, this is far from being easy. But we succeed because we are unapologetic and unwavering in our editorial line. We believe that a newspaper is a place for people to hear a wide range of opinions and ideas, and that our job is to present to you, our readers and our listeners, the entire spectrum. The whole point of our existence is to debate the tough issues and ask the tough questions. As the primary newspaper for the Jewish world, I believe that the Jerusalem Post is carrying on its role faithfully, taking issues that are at the heart of controversy in Israel, the region, and the diaspora, and confronting them head on. We don't shy away from the tough issues. We embrace them. For this week's episode, we're bringing you two highlights from the conference that took place in Gotham Hall in New York before a packed crowd of more than 500 people. The first is an interview Lahav did with U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Tom Nides, who flew to New York for the event. The second is a panel I moderated with Bahraini Ambassador to the United States, Sheikh Abdullah bin Rashid bin Abdullah Al Khalifa, Morocco's Ambassador to the United Nations, Omer Hilal, and Israel's Ambassador to the United Nations, Gilad Erdan. I hope you enjoy.
Tom Nides is the United States Ambassador to Israel and sits at the epicenter of what I think a lot of us who are here today hold dearly, the Israel-U.S. alliance. We're honored to have Ambassador Nides here with us today. Ladies and gentlemen, let's please give a warm welcome to U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Tom Nides, for an onstage interview with Lahav Harkov.
Ambassador Nides, thank you so much for being here and for coming out all the way to New York. This is a time where things have looked a little bit tense between the Biden administration and the current government in Israel over events happening in the West Bank. Israel and Jerusalem and Washington, I would say, don't 100% see eye to eye on what the response should be to the growing violence by Palestinians in the West Bank. Is that perception that's coming from the media reporting, is that how you see things?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. I did arrive here about 4 o'clock this morning. I was thinking to myself, I came all the way for 20 minutes, but for you, I'll do it. For Jerusalem Post, I'll do it. So that was a plug for your newspaper.
Well, first of all, let me just step back for a second. As many of you know, President Biden had a trip to Israel about a month ago. And yes, I'm just a tad bit biased, but I thought it was one hell of a trip, okay? I think his expression that you do not have to be a Jew to be a Zionist was a beautiful way to start a remarkable trip. His view around going to Yad Vashem and standing and kneeling and holding the hands of those two beautiful women who are Holocaust survivors, holding the hands, giving them kisses, talking about their experiences, showed his caring about Israel and this unbreakable tie that we have between Israel and the United States. Unbreakable. And the support of the defense of the state of Israel through the MOU and through Iron Dome. This guy lived this for the last 45 years. I think it came out on the trip. One of the things, and I talk about this a lot, my North Star is maintaining a democratic Jewish state. That is the single most important thing I believe that I can do as an American ambassador. And to do that, we have to send a message of the important unbreakable security alliance between the United States and Israel. And the importance of making sure everyone understands this relationship between the United States, between the IDF and the Defense Department and our security industries are critically important to that. And part of this idea of this unbreakable bond is also the importance of maintaining a two-state solution. The vision of a two-state solution is important to Joe Biden, important to keeping and maintaining a democratic Jewish state. And yes, we spent a lot of time working with Israel and working with the West Bank and Abbas and attempting to try to keep that vision alive. So yes, we push all the time. We push the Palestinians. I just heard comments about the Taylor Force Act, which obviously we support and enforce. At the same time, we push aggressively with the Israelis on things that we think is important to keep the vision of two-state solution. So there are agreements and there are disagreements.
I want to get into specifically some of the things that have come up. First of all, after the tragic killing of the journalist, Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, which apparently or was likely to have been by an IDF soldier, although there's no sort of a conclusive evidence, but that's what the IDF, both the IDF and the U.S. found in their investigations. The response from the State Department was to say that Israel needs to reconsider its rules of engagement. Now, the rules of engagement have been a controversial issue in Israel for years, without the Americans bringing it up. But it comes at a time that I had mentioned of rising violence in the West Bank. Do you think that's part of the U.S. looking out for Israel's security?
Well, first of all, my heart breaks for Shireen's family. I went to the wake and spent time with Shireen's brother and niece, and my heart breaks for her. We obviously spent a great deal. She's an American citizen. We spent a great deal of time working both with the IDF and the Palestinian Authority to try to come up with some conclusions of what happened. Yes, the IDF ultimately concurred, as we did, that it was likely, not intentionally, by the way. We said that, the IDF said that it's likely that, sadly, the IDF likely shot her. This is a dangerous place. Janine was a dangerous place. She's a reporter. My wife is a reporter. It's very difficult to do these jobs. Very complicated. But we need to make sure the media has the right and the ability to cover the stories. So yes, the United States has said, as we do, as America does, as America is the most powerful military in the world, we are constantly relooking at our rules of engagement. I have an enormous respect for the IDF. I spent an enormous amount of my time working with the IDF, the soldiers, the leaders. I've done hundreds of events with the IDF. They're a phenomenal, phenomenal military, and they have unbelievable cooperation with the U.S. Defense Department. So I am one who
hopes to always continue to improve, and that's what we were trying to do and talk about with the IDF. Israel is a sovereign country. They will make decisions about what they believe is the right thing to do to protect their people. We understand that, and we support that.
All right. So another issue that's come up is sort of Israel's standards of letting people in to Judea and Samaria, the West Bank. And there are some disagreements. The Kogat, which is the sort of military governor of that area, they've loosened some of the rules, but not enough. So could you, I think it's a little bit of a complicated issue that maybe not that many people understand. Can you explain the U.S. stance on that issue?
Sure. I mean, I spent a lot of time, again, Kogat is part of the IDF. I spent an enormous amount of time with the generals on the ground. We're continuing to encourage equal access to the West Bank for Americans who have blue passports to be able to freely operate within the West Bank. We're continually trying to improve that. And to the credit of the IDF, it's not perfect vis-a-vis the rules. We're working every day to try to improve them. That's what we do. That's what the United States does. We attempt to try to work with our allies and our friends to make things better. So we will try to continue to do that, and I have enormous respect for the team of the military that we've been working with, and we work with them every day. So hopefully we'll continue to work as these rules become clearer and clearer over the next 40-some days.
So Israel and the U.S. started this process of a visa-free travel agreement, which is unfortunately gotten stuck because of, for political reasons, really. We probably would be close to completing it if we didn't have an election. But one of the issues was about letting U.S. citizens enter Israel without harassment in the airport and letting them into the West Bank. So if you could just get into what the issue is specifically.
Okay, so just let's be clear. There are 30 countries in the world that you do not need a visa to visit the United States. When I got to this job, I said, why is it not Israel one of those countries? Why should Israelis need to stand in line, which is an enormous pain for many of you who have family members? Why can we not make sure our most important ally in the Middle East not have the ability to come without going and getting a visa? That was my goal, okay? No more complicated than that. My friend Howard Kaur at AIPAC called me the first day I was nominated. He said, you got to get that visa waiver program done. And I have spent almost every day, at least a portion of my day, trying to figure this out. And we're close. We're very close. But be clear, the only way that is going to happen is not only a bunch of technical issues, we've got hundreds of people working on this, is we're going to make sure that if you're an American and you have a blue passport, and you live in Detroit and you want to go to the West Bank, you're going to be able to go through Ben-Gurion Airport to the West Bank and vice versa from the West Bank to Ben-Gurion Airport. That's called reciprocity. And I think ultimately we'll get to where we need to be. But the most important thing in my view is very simple, that Israelis, who are an enormously important ally, should be just like many European countries that are able to go to the United States without standing in line to get a visa. That is my goal, and that's what I'm attempting to try to get done.
So on to a different topic, which is Iran. Right now,
that's easy. This will be controversial. Okay.
Right now we're in, it seems like a lull in the Iran talks process. Israel doesn't really want an Iran deal, at least most of the officials don't.
Yeah.
They're sort of optimistic that this lull may end up being permanent. A senior diplomatic figure told journalists today that the U.S. was shown intelligence. Israel showed the U.S. and the European parties to the talks intelligence to show that Iran had been lying. And that because of that, the U.S. has toughened its stance when it comes to the Iran talks. Is there anything you could say to that?
Well, let me first start. Joe Biden has made it very clear. He will not stand by and let the Iranians obtain a nuclear weapon. He has said that over and over and over again, number one. Number two, he has said, and he's told that to Prime Minister Lapid, and he said it publicly, we do not tie Israel's hands to defend itself against aggressors. Number three, Number three, we've also said under the right circumstances, the terms that we have laid out, yes, we'd like to get returned to the JCPOA. But those, unfortunately at this point, those objections have not been made. The ball is in the Iranians' court. Joe Biden has been very, very clear about this. Example, the FTO, the Foreign Terrorist Organization. Everyone's like, oh, the Iranians want us to get the designation off, and Joe Biden is going to let that happen. No, Joe Biden did not let that happen. And the Iranians backed away. So ultimately, we believe the right thing is to have a diplomatic solution to this. And you're right. There are plenty in Israel and the government who disagree with that. One thing Joe Biden made it very clear when he became president, there will be no light between the two countries, meaning no secrets, everything is shared, complete transparency what we're doing. They know it. I'm not in any way suggesting they like necessarily like it, but we are completely in tune. They know what we know what they know, and they know, understandable, the only way we're going to get back into the JCPOA is the conditions that we laid out are met. And right now, they have not been met.
All right. One more question. I wanted to, let's play the game of where in the world is Amos Hochstein, the U.S. Special Envoy for Energy, who has been shuttling back and forth between Israel and Lebanon, Israel, sometimes stopping in France, to figure out where the maritime border between Israel and Lebanon will be, mainly so that Lebanon can start developing its gas fields and start selling gas and making some money for its completely collapsed economy. How are those talks going? I've been hearing a lot of optimistic things from Jerusalem that they're near the end. And also, is there any consideration or any attention being paid to ensuring that gas money doesn't go to Hezbollah?
Well, there's a lot of questions there, and I can't answer a few of them. But I will say the following. Our negotiator, which is Amos, and with obviously he's the envoy from the president, is working very close with Prime Minister Lapid and Defense Minister Gantz and the national security team in Israel, trying to come up with a solution. I do not believe Israel wants a military conflict with Lebanon, and I don't believe Lebanon or Hezbollah wants a military confrontation with Israel. We're going to do whatever we can to get something done here to avoid that situation. We are in the middle of those discussions. I happen to have been in one of those discussions a couple days ago. We're very involved in the details. These are very complicated issues. It's not just, you know, one line or two lines. It's just we're dealing with complicated government, to say, in Lebanon. We all understand how complicated that is. We're understanding these are territorial issues, and this is not just about money. It has a lot more to do with sovereignty than just about money, but these are important, obviously, to Israel and their desires to do exploration in there, and obviously it's complicated, obviously. Lebanon. So my hope, I'm an optimistic guy. You have to be to have this job. I'm an optimistic guy, and I think we'll ultimately get to the right place for both for Israel and the maritime issue.
So that's an optimistic note. I'll ask you another question that'll hopefully have us end on.
I thought it was done already. Okay.
Well, nobody's signaling to me that we have to get off stage, so I'm going to ask you one more thing. What is your favorite part about being ambassador to Israel?
That's the kind of questions I like. Here's the deal. It's an unbelievable honor to be the American ambassador to Israel. I cannot... Listen, I've been blessed. I've had a lot of good jobs, and I've had a good history. I wake up every day and say to myself, wow, America's relationship with Israel is like unbreakable. And our relation, Israel's relationship with the United States is equally that. When I came to Israel, I didn't really realize this is not about just America helping its important ally, which we do. But Israel helps America in 1,000 different ways, which I had no idea till I got into this job. It's like, and it's not just the leadership, it's in the DNA of our military and our intelligence operations. It's in the culture. It's the, I mean, listen, the two words I wish I never said to my friends is come visit, okay? Because everyone comes to visit. Everyone cares about Israel, okay? I don't care if you're a Jew or an Arab or a Christian or anything in between. Everyone wants to be there, and the vast, vast majority of people love it. And how cool is it to be the guy to represent America in Israel? So it's a great job. It's a huge honor. It is not for the faint of heart, I assure you. Every time I open my mouth, I'm sure I get someone aggravated. But the reality of this is I come to this from my heart. I want this to maintain a democratic Jewish state, and I'm proud of this relationship, and I'll do everything I can to keep it strong. Thank you very much.
Tom Nines, U.S. Ambassador to Israel. Thank you very much.
We now have a real treat, something that we've never done before at the Jerusalem Post, which is a panel and in line with the Abraham Accords, with Arab members of the ambassadors here to the United States and to the United Nations and Israelis. So it's my honor to be joined on stage by the Bahraini ambassador to the United States, Sheikh Abdallah bin Rashid bin Abdallah Al Khalifa. Mr. Ambassador, please. The Morocco's ambassador to the United Nations, Omer Hilal. And last but not least, Israel's ambassador to the United Nations, former Israeli minister Gilad Erdan. Gentlemen, please. So, Ambassador Erdan, I thought we'd start with you. We're going to be marking now 2 years since the signing of the Abraham Accords, significant milestone. And I'm curious how the Accords have impacted your work at the UN, and in your view, how have they impacted the region as a whole?
Good morning, Yaakov. Good morning, dear friends. I'm very happy to be here with you in this important panel. And regarding your question, first of all, I'll say that the Accords have truly impacted my role at the UN, and they made also an historic transformation in the region. And let me elaborate for a little bit. At the UN, my role is to try and deepen the implementation of the Accord. Every day I wake up and I try to think of creative ways in order to demonstrate the new coexistence that we enjoy, and also maybe to find joint mutual solutions to the to the challenges that we are trying to tackle. For example, first time ever that a Moroccan ambassador lit the menorah candles during Hanukkah while together with Omar, my dear friend here. No, it was really exciting and moving. I also had the opportunity to plant olive trees together with my dear friend Yusuf Eloteba in Washington when we celebrated Earth Day, conveying and demonstrating our commitment to fight together climate change. So I think there are many opportunities, but at the UN, I have to highlight the fact that things are not going to change overnight, the voting right. patterns, because many times the voting patterns are based not on the bilateral relations with the other country, but due to their commitments to their regional or religious groups. But still I see a change. For example, many more countries that Israel don't have diplomatic relations feel that it's legitimate to speak with me. When I presented the resolution against Holocaust denial and distortion, historically, the Arab League would oppose it automatically because it's an Israeli-led resolution. This year, thank God, they decided to support it. Iran was the only one to oppose it. So we see the progress. Right. We see it.
So, Ambassador Khalifa, can you share with us the viewpoint from Bahrain? And I'm also curious, your country is physically close to Saudi Arabia. You're in the Gulf. other countries have yet to come and normalize relations with Israel. What's your projection of where things are going and what direction? Can we see more countries come? What are you hearing from your Saudi friends in Riyadh? Where do you see this happening?
Well, thank you, Yaakov. Good morning to everyone. And if you allow me to very quickly start out with sending out my heartfelt condolences to everyone who has lost a loved one back in 2001. That was a horrific time. I was a student, an MBA student up in Boston, and I felt the grief, and I think that was an eye-opener for me. It really showed me the importance of tolerance and coexistence and the dangers of extremism. And it really put Bahrain on a track where we saw how His Majesty has embraced the notion of peaceful coexistence and tolerance. And that's why we're here today. It's one thing after the other that led to the announcement of Bahrain to extend its relations with the State of Israel. But honestly, it's 2 years, nearly 2 years, and we've seen a lot happen on a government-to-government level. But I do want to shed some light on the people that have been most impacted, which is the indigenous Bahraini Jewish society. I mean, it's been a while since we've seen a bar mitzvah. It's been a while since we've seen a Jewish wedding in Bahrain, and not because of the laws, but because of choice. And here we are seeing a very different landscape in Bahrain that we hope becomes more normal in the region as time goes by. In terms of what we were...
Be careful what you ask for, because it doesn't start with one synagogue. It's two, three, four, then they don't go to one,
hey,
they
listen,
don't go to the other.
I've been to two synagogues in less than a week.
There you go.
But, you know, what's important for us is to sustain the momentum here.
Right.
And with the development of the Negev Forum, now we have a forum where we can see not only bilateral things happen, but on a multilateral level. There are working groups that have been established. We know for a fact that we will be working on six different areas in the years to come, and that's going to move countries closer together and create the club that we want to highlight in order for us to make it easier for others to join as time goes by.
Okay. Ambassador Hilal, as opposed to the UAE and Bahrain, for Morocco, the Abraham Accords were less about normalization, but more about this term that I heard from people in your office called reconnection. And that's because there were diplomatic ties in the past. So how have the last 2 years strengthened this relationship between Israel and Morocco?
Assalamu alaikum. Shalom. I have... Thank you. I prefer the word of continuum than reconnection. And continuum is more than reconnection, and in my point of view, more than normalization. Because it's continuum of 3,000 years of history of the existence of Jewish people in Morocco. It's also continuum of the links that have been existing between Morocco and Israel thanks to the Moroccan Jewish community in Israel, which now is reaching more than 900,000 people. But I should recognize that Abraham Accords create real dynamics between Morocco and Israel. And we witness now several exchanges of visits, ministers of defense, minister of trade, minister of education, minister of interior, chief of the Israeli army, and by the way, the inspector general of the Moroccan army is visiting Israel tomorrow. That's
right.
The first time that is happening.
Right.
So, and it's triggering also the exchange between Morocco and Israel. Based on the last information of the very recent report of the United Nations, the exchange between Morocco and Israel, and especially the export to Israel, increased for three times this year. So, and the opportunities are huge. Now it's just depending of investors of coming from Israel, and also about the economic capacity of exports by Morocco. And we believe that this agreement or this accord are giving to the Israeli economy and investors and traders access to more than 2.5 billion 500 million citizens in the world, thanks to the agreement of free trade agreements that Morocco have signed with several countries. So it means that Morocco will be the gate of Israel to so many other countries. And for us, it's very important as opportunities and also as chance to play in creating prosperity and deepening the relationship between the two countries.
Inshallah, as they say.
Inshallah.
Ambassador Erdogan, we said a lot of the positive words about the Abraham Accords, but there is a large dark shadow that is lurking over the Middle East, and that is Iran. I'm curious what your opinion is of what can be done by either Israel and alongside some of its new regional partners.
Well, Yaakov, this is maybe the most important question, because it will influence the whole future of our region. So let me start by explaining why we oppose so strongly the revival of the old Iran deal, the JCPOA. For Israel, a nuclear Iran is an existential threat. Everyone understands it. Even the most moderate leaders of Iran, like Rafsanjani, used to call Israel a one-bomb state. And the deal that we are talking about does not even solve the one thing that it was meant to solve, meaning stopping Iran from acquiring nuclear capabilities. Why? Because it has, as we all know, the sunset clauses that mean that in 2 to 7 years from now, Iran will be able to enrich uranium even almost without limitations, to acquire and use advanced centrifuges, and even the snapback mechanism that exists today will expire in 2025. So it means signing the deal is only kicking the can down the road, and it's not going to be a long road, 2 to 7 years. But it's not only a threat to Israel. This is a clear threat to our region, because it does not address even, you know, Iran's ballistic missile program, or the fact that they continue what we call their malign activities in our region to support their terrorist proxies, not only Hezbollah and Hamas that are threatening Israel, but also the Houthis that are launching attack drones against Saudi Arabia or against the UAE, and they continue to test intercontinental ballistic missiles. We understand that their true goal is to export the Shiite revolution everywhere. So the only formula in order to stop Iran, this was your question, is a combination of three components. First, to isolate Iran diplomatically here at the UN and elsewhere. Secondly, to trigger the snapback mechanism in a way that it will impose crippling sanctions over Iran. But thirdly, maybe most importantly, to present Iran with a credible military threat. Yaakov, President Roosevelt said, speak softly, but carry a big stick. We have spoken softly with Iran for so many years, and now it's maybe it's the last moment to present them with a real credible military threat that would force them to decide between their own survival as a regime and their crazy, dangerous nuclear ambitions. Without that, it won't happen. I think our partners, and I'm not going to speak on behalf of their foreign policy, but we all hear the new architecture to develop, you know, missile defense systems. I hope it will happen with the leadership of the United States, but that's the only way.
So, Ambassador Khalifa, Bahrain's Royal Highness, the King Hamad, has asked nothing of the U.S. when it came to normalize relations between Israel and your country. But there is talk of one of your more pressing needs is this multi-layered missile defense system. And Gilad Erdan just referenced that. Is now the time for that to happen? Is this the moment?
Yaakov, the time was yesterday. I mean, honestly, like Israel, Bahrain was forced to, within its defense architecture, within its defense commitments towards our national security interests, we were compelled to, that defense calculus needed to exist because of the potential threat, whether it's direct or indirect, that might come from the Islamic Republic. And so we needed to hire our defenses. And the only way to do it is to work with traditional partners and to work with new partners and new allies. And so on his recent visit to Washington, D.C., His Royal Highness the Crown Prince and Prime Minister stated very bluntly the importance of establishing a security architecture for the region that obviously includes the U.S., Bahrain, other countries in the region, including Israel. Now, what you mentioned as an air and missile defense system is only one component within a bigger kind of security blanket that we're looking at. And so it shouldn't come as a surprise that Bahrain signed a defense agreement with Israel, the only Arab country that has signed a defense agreement thus far. As a matter of fact, what that does is it doesn't only include an IDF officer in Bahrain working alongside Bahrainis and Americans right. at the Fifth Fleet, but it also opens up the opportunity for that officer to work alongside
other countries
yes. That are part of multiple coalitions that work out of Bahrain. So this is a priority for us. We're hopeful that we can create a system, but I think what we also have to do is to work in parallel to ensure that there is some sort of dialogue with Iran, because without dialogue and without diplomacy, it just becomes a very difficult task. So right. diplomacy on one side, but also building out an infrastructure that can support us and help deter any violence that we see on a regular basis, on a daily basis, to our social fabric is what we are doing right now. Right.
So I want to shift gears. Ambassador Hilal, Israel and Morocco have also signed a number of agreements. There's been education, economic agreements. There's been some military things that have also gone on. And you referenced how the chief of staff of Morocco will be in Israel this week. And our chief of staff was recently in Morocco. Why is all of this, all these agreements, why are they important for Morocco? And what is the Morocco looking to get out of them?
I think Abraham Accords and the bilateral agreements that have been signed between Israel and Morocco are very important and crucial, not only for our two countries, but for the rest, for our region, Middle East, and for the rest of the world. Because any peace agreement should not be just a paper. We should give and take concrete steps to make it concrete. We should take and agree about new roads of development, investment, cooperation, partnership, to let the people in the field, every citizen, will feel that the peace has a sense, the peace has a value. The peace is not paper, but it's mind. It's in the heart. It's everything. It's daily. And I think by this agreement on agriculture, on energy, on water, on defense, and on education, because we are having many joint agreements between universities.
Right.
And the best investment is in education, as you know. And Israel has the expert technology in water. And agriculture, Morocco has the largest reserve of phosphate in the world. We have fertilizers, so cooperation between Israel and Morocco can benefit to the rest of the world. And just last year, we organized the first ever side event that between Morocco and Israel on agriculture for Africa. And you remember, it was the
food
first
security.
One. Food security. And this is the security. Food security is crucial for people.
So we're about to lose or drop out of time here. I got three questions left. Can you give me each a quick answer? So I'll start with you, Ambassador Hilal. There was a Council of Ministers meeting in July where His Majesty King Muhammad VI endorsed a reorganization of the Jewish community. And you mentioned how it's a thousands-year-old Jewish community and the restoration of synagogues and cemeteries. Why was this important for the king? Why was this important in your view?
It's not a surprise because he's doing that for Moroccan citizens. Because we don't have a Jewish community. We have a Moroccan Jewish or Jewish Moroccan. But it's not community living apart. And the fact that His Majesty the King is the commander of the faithful, it means that he's protecting Muslims, he's protecting Jewish, and he's protecting Christians, right, who belongs to the same family, the same nation, and the same unity of our country. And it's his duty to help the Jewish community to organize itself and also to create a commission abroad for Moroccan Jewish abroad to keep the links between the Moroccans living abroad and those living in Israel and those living in Morocco. And we create also, thanks to His Majesty the King, this Jewish foundation.
Right.
To help working and enhancing the relationship. And this link between the Moroccan in Israel and the Moroccan in Morocco are a real bridge that is giving the example and the proof that peace is possible. Living together is possible. Not only coexisting, but accepting the other is possible, and building better future for the new next generation and for our children.
A beautiful message. A beautiful message.
Possible.
Ambassador Khalifa, if you can do it in 1 minute. Business opportunities, investments in Bahrain, Israel and Bahrain, America and Bahrain. What do you got to pitch to the people who are here?
I'll do it in 10 seconds. Everyone here needs to pitch in. There are business opportunities everywhere. You asked me a question a couple of minutes ago. You said, who's the next country? And I say, let's make this work to bring in other countries. And the only way we can do it is through multilateral approaches. And I think we have a good crowd here that wants to look at the success of the Accords. Come to us and we'll find win-win-win situations.
And Ambassador Adan, to finish us off, we've spoken about the deepening of the Abraham Accords. We've spoken about the way to expand them. Any impact maybe on the Palestinians?
First, let me join the optimism part, the optimistic part, and say that I'm sure that this process is 100% irreversible, because we understand that there are two shifts, that the combination of them truly is reshaping the future of our region. The psychological shifts where so many, you know, millions of Jews getting to know millions of Arabs, and the fact that we never had wars before. So now this psychological shift, in addition to the creation of warm peace that allow, you know, business to business, everyone can meet everyone, and everybody can see the fruits of our peace, to be exposed to what we can gain out of it. So I'm sure many more Muslim countries will follow suit. We saw what happened during President Biden's visit to our region, the decision of Saudi Arabia to open its airspace to Israeli airlines. Saudi Arabia will definitely be one day a game changer. So I'm very optimistic. But regarding the Palestinians, let me...
20 seconds. Close.
Yes. Right now, with Abu Mazen, there's no hope. We know, you know, he continues on the unilateral track to spread lies and incitement. Next week, he's going to come to the UN, demand full membership status. Spoiler alert, he's not going to get it because he needs 9 votes at the Security Council, or he will get... a veto from the American administration. It's not going to happen. But after Abu Mazen, I'm sure that the young generation of Palestinians, once they're exposed to the fruits of our peace, and after so many millions of us are going to encounter each other, it will influence maybe to the positions within the Palestinian society to become more moderate, and with the help of the new mediators that we have, mediators like Morocco, Bahrain, and the UAE, in addition to Egypt and Jordan. So I'm hopeful that one day maybe the Palestinian will understand that peace is the right way, is the better way.
Bezrat Hashem, please God. And thank you very much to our ambassadors, Ambassador Al Khalifa, Ambassador Hilal, and Ambassador of Israel to the United Nations, Gilad Erdan. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this week's Jerusalem Post podcast. You can find us on all the players that play podcasts. Share widely and share with all your friends and family. Look forward to hearing from you and seeing you next week.